This is the WHFR Journal, our July 26th edition. Thank you for tuning in and happy summer. Hope you're enjoying this summer season. I can't believe it's already late July, but one of the things that is very exciting about this time of season, in fact, kicking off a week from today, is the Dearborn Homecoming Festival. We are so fortunate to have an event like this literally in our own backyard here in the Dearborn community, and we want to tell you, our wonderful WHFR listeners, about what's in store. The event takes place August 2, 3, and 4. That's right, literally next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and there truly is something to do for everyone. And to give us all of the details about what we can expect, those of us that have been traditionally attending homecoming for years and years and years, including WHFR, or maybe we've got some newbies listening today that are like, Dearborn Homecoming, what's this all about? We're going to cover all the bases. Erica Mara is joining us at this time. She is the special event and outreach manager for the city of Dearborn, and certainly no stranger to the Homecoming Festival. Erica, You've got at least a couple of these under your belt now, and I suspect it doesn't really get any easier necessarily in the planning, but welcome, and how are you doing this summer season?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me. And yes, we're all looking forward to the Dearborn Homecoming Festival coming up, as you said, very quickly in just 2 short weeks.
Yes, it really is flying by this summer season, no doubt. But this is the staple for so many people in this community. Why do you think that's so? Why is Dearborn Homecoming so important from your perspective of being, you know, planning and coordinating and everything? Because you get to see all the ins and the outs. So what makes it so special?
Yeah, so believe it or not, Dearborn Homecoming Festival is in its 43rd year this year. So we're celebrating its 43rd birthday. As a resident of Dearborn, growing up here myself and going to Dearborn Homecoming and now serving as director of the festival, you really feel the heart and you really feel the connection and the tradition that each of the residents of Dearborn has with this festival. And it's really special. People look forward to this every year. People always reach out ahead of time and, you know, ask for the details, are very excited about everything. You really see the connection leading up to the festival in this community and on site there as well. This festival has a lot of traditional aspects to it. Of course, we have a lot of community representation, cultural representation, and we're hoping to always connect with that, always honor that, as well as build upon the festival year to year as well.
Yeah, I like that. Past, present, and future, that, as any good event should be. Well, Erica, as director of the event, I know you have indicated in the past that planning really, you know, you didn't just start this last month. I mean, this literally takes, I'm hoping you had a little break in there between 2023's event, you know, and then starting for 24. But how long has this effort been going on? And what does the team look like? How many people does it take, let's say, to make homecoming happen?
Yeah, I took a couple day break last year, but really this festival takes about a year to plan. And honestly, it could even take more time than that. You know, if I had it, I'd use it. But yeah, this is really about a year's worth of planning that's coming together for this 3-day weekend. We have a small but mighty team that puts this festival together. We work very hard. And I think one thing that people may not notice about this festival is that this is a city sponsored festival. So everyone that works on this festival, for the most part, we do have some seasonal employees that come in as well, is a city of Dearborn employee. So as everyone is working their full-time jobs, they're also helping to plan this extravagant festival that we host every year. So it's a lot of effort. It's a lot of work, but it's such a worthy cause. And it's such a fun experience and such a fun project that we all get to work on that might be separate from a lot of people's day-to-day that we really come together and look forward to this every year. But yes, it is a process.
No doubt. We will be talking with Mayor Hamoud a little bit later this, you know, between now and the homecoming itself, just to get his perspective and his take. But I appreciate that sort of from the boots on the ground people, you know, the ones that have to make every detail come together and so on. And I the undertaking, my goodness. But when we get there for the weekend event, kicking off as early as Friday with the All-Stars and so on, which one of our very favorite things to participate in, we'll talk about that in a minute. It really does seem like the sense of community is always front and center. I mean, there's the food and there's the vendors and the art and the music, certainly the entertainment and so on. But it just, that sense of community, I think, is what makes it so special, including people returning to the community that are not necessarily current Dearborn residents or, you know, community members, but they come back, they literally plan their vacations around this very special event. And that's got to feel, pretty good for you and that small but mighty team, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. We, of course, host reunions for Dearborn Area High School, and I believe a couple middle schools as well, if they like. We have a reunion area set aside at the festival for people to host some of those high school or middle school reunions. And then I've also had a lot of people reach out to me, especially this year, which was kind of cool and surprising. I have my 10-year high school reunion this year, and I've had a few people reach out to me and be like, we really want the reunion to, you know, fall around homecoming so we can make the trip back from out of state, things like that. So that felt really good to me. That made me feel pretty special that we're building something that people do want to come back to and carve out time and money to come back to the Dearborn area and be a part of this. But yeah, we're looking forward to that. We welcome everyone to come back.
We know that members of neighboring communities enjoy this festival as well. It is not exclusive to the city of Dearborn. Everyone's welcome, of course. And we also know that events like the Headliners Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the wonderful fireworks, which again, we'll give you some details in just a little bit on that as well. This is a community festival, but this is a community festival and a force to be reckoned with. This is something that attracts people from all around. Do you have numbers or general statistics from 2023's event? And I suspect this one will be only bigger and better. So like, how many people are we talking about? Yeah.
So of course, this is a free non-ticketed event. So it's hard to get exact numbers, but our best estimate from last year, we think it was one of the biggest years in the festival's history. We estimate about 20,000 people over the weekend.
That's a lot. Yeah. At the same time, the expansive venue allows it not to feel like 20,000 people are arm to arm, like at a tight concert venue or something like that. And that's what we love about the grounds of Ford Field Park, of course, in Dearborn as well. And that return, and I know last year's was kind of like a return to Ford Field, and this year's theme, There's No Place Like Homecoming. Just love that. And our movie buffs had better know the reference. And I'm not even going to say it because they should know. You should
Absolutely.
Know, by the way. Listeners. Yeah. So probably all of what I'm going to ask you about next is going to be housed in that wonderful website called DearbornHomecoming.com, right? Mm-hmm. So if somebody has a question about a date or a performer or any very specific thing, absolutely recommend go to DearbornHomecoming.com. But from, again, a planning perspective, it must be very exciting to have the headliners, these three, you know, wonderful yet diverse acts coming in, which is one of, again, the sort of the staples of Dearborn Homecoming. These are major acts. So tell us a little bit about the major entertainment for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I know you'll want to allude to at least some of the local artists that pop in as well and do some things throughout the weekend.
So I would say, just to kind of start off there, myself and the team, the homecoming team, kind of have two goals with the festival moving forward. One is to put on something cool and worthwhile for the people of Dearborn because they deserve it. And we deserve cool things just like any other city. And two, we really want to put Dearborn on the map. You mentioned other communities coming in, visitors from other places. And one of the best ways to do that is with some big name talent. So this year we kind of stepped it up a little bit. Friday, we have the Verve Pipe headlining. They're an alt rock band. Saw a lot of popularity in the 90s and early 2000s. On Saturday, we have the All-American Rejects. And then on Sunday, we're leaning into our countryside with Kylie Morgan. So those are our three headliners for the weekend. We also have that full talent schedule, as you mentioned, at DearbornHomecoming.com. We'll be releasing the day-by-day lineups very soon, so you can see exactly what time each of your favorite artists or anyone you want to see are playing as well. And then we round out the festival with a great batch of local talent ranging many different genres, from like soul and R&B to alt rock to country, to indie R&B as well. We're really mixing it up this year, and we want to give people as much variety as we can. To that note, we've also added a secondary music stage to house some of those additional artists this year. So as we've gone through a bit of a rebranding process, we're moving forward and announcing the new names of our stages this year. So what you knew as the main stage last year is now the Sunset Stage. And the secondary music stage that we've added, which is activated earlier in the day, is the Sunrise Stage. So earlier in the day is the sunrise, later in the day is the sunset. So if you hear sunset, that is formerly our main stage. We also have our Cultural Pavilion stage, which made a debut last year. It's changing its location a little bit, but not very far. Again, you can find that site map online at DearbornHomecoming.com. That will be housed in our Cultural Pavilion. It'll honor those traditional favorites. We'll have a Debka troupe. We'll also have polka music there. So people looking for that kind of entertainment can find it in the Cultural Pavilion on that stage. And then we also have a kids stage full of entertainment for children and families. So we have things like magicians, we have dinosaur fossil exhibits, we have bubble dance parties. We've got a lot going on that is free and family friendly.
All right, so bubble dance parties. Please tell me
Yes.
that's all ages, right? Because I
Oh,
think that
absolutely.
sounds cool. I'm not gonna
Welcome
lie.
to all.
That's wonderful. When we get into even just the three headliners that you mentioned. So yeah, talk about variety. Goodness. I know the Verve Pipe Michiganders
Yes.
originally, which is very cool. They're coming home for that as well. And then wow, All American Rejects. So I'm just thinking about some of their songs and how motivating they are. And then, of course, who doesn't love country music in Metro Detroit? So you really are
Sure.
hitting a variety of genre there, as you indicated, and that's certainly going to be appealing to everybody. We keep talking about Ford Field again, Dearborn's Ford Field, not Ford Field, Detroit.
Yes.
Different Ford Field, yes, but the venue indicate as you indicate, sort of making some changes, moving some things around a little bit, but the location itself certainly is ample and allowing the opportunity to shift around. Sounds like that's something that you probably do based on both interest and just desire to grow the festival, but also maybe best practices of what works best, what hasn't worked as well, and so on. Do you factor in a lot of that kind of feedback?
Absolutely. We learn new things every year. We learn from our mistakes every year. Our goal is to really just make this the best user experience possible and best attendee experience for our guests. My goal is for people to not think about the site while they're there, other than maybe, wow, this looks great, or wow, this feels good. I want this to just be a really seamless experience where they can go have a great time, kind of let their hair down a little bit, so to speak, and just enjoy themselves. So we work really hard behind the scenes to kind of make sure the flow of everything feels good. A lot of thought is put into that in our year of planning. And again, we're trying to, add new things every year, offer as much as we can, especially at this, this festival is very accessible. We want people to, not only come for those big name headliners near the end of the night, but also have something to do the entire day throughout the hours that the festival is open.
Well, let's lead into that and remind our listeners, Erica Mara is joining us, and she is Special Event and Outreach Manager for the City of Dearborn and Festival Manager. Erica, in terms of just basic hours for each day for the weekend, and we don't have to go down the list of, obviously everything. That's what that wonderful website is for. But I know it kicks off early on Friday for those special all-stars. Let's talk a little bit about that and then basic festival hours.
Start with the hours. So we are open. General festival hours are from noon to 10:30 p.m. each night. Each day of the festival, so on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we have a fun activity that will occur before the general festival hours open. As you mentioned, Friday, that's All Stars Day. That's open from 9 to 1. And a little bit more about All Stars Day, if you're not familiar, that is a time that we set aside, kind of like an event within an event that we organize for those with special needs. It is a sensory friendly way to experience the festival. So that's why we have it a little bit before GA doors open, so people can come in, enjoy the carnival at, less flashing lights, lower volumes. We have a number of different activities for that group of people as well. It's open to both children and adults. A lot of sensory friendly stations, sensory stations. We also have food. We have a DJ. We have balloon art, clowns, anything that you could want. That's from 9 to 1 on August 2nd, the Friday of the festival. There are other activities that we have going on throughout the weekend, including the Dearborn Decades 5K, as well as the Dearborn Community Bike Ride with Mayor Hamoun. That's put on by Bike Dearborn. So if you'd like more information about those activities, you can head to dearbornhomecoming.com.
Okay, sounds great. So some of these events will be things potentially that people should plan to register for in advance so that they can be prepared to be there, especially like a race or something like that.
Absolutely.
And then, but and most things, obviously, you just kind of show up and enjoy the festival. And you mentioned the carnival component of it, which I know is so big for the younger people as well that are attending. But is DearbornHomecoming.com the place to find links and things for all of those registration type events?
Absolutely. You can find registration there for the Dearborn Classic Car Show, All Stars Day, the Dearborn Decades 5K, the Community Bike Ride. We also have our full schedule of events on that page as well. Our food truck lineup, Venner Village lineup, anything that you could want regarding Dearborn Homecoming Festival can be found at dearbornhomecoming.com.
Have to ask about the food. It really is something that makes this festival extra special, especially for some of us that will be there all weekend staffing a tent, which we love to do. Again, absolutely stop by the WHFR broadcast booth on your weekend there. Say hello, especially if you're returning to the community. We love our alumni as well, so we'd love to talk to you. But in terms of food, they're true. I mean, I think it's easy to say, oh, sure, there's something for everybody, but to actually mean it, you know, and back that up with the reality that there honestly is something for everybody at Dearborn Homecoming. Talk about a little bit about the variety, the expansive variety of what people can expect.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you nailed it when you said there is something for everyone. We're welcoming roughly 10 different food trucks that offer a variety of different cuisines. They range from tacos to desserts to Mediterranean food, pretty much anything you could want that we're offering in our food truck corridor this year. And then in addition to that, we also have our cultural pavilion. We have some food vendors in there as well. We are featuring, so what you may have formerly known as like the Polish tent, the Italian tent, and the Arab tent can all be found under the cultural pavilion this year, just for some clarity and some context. So we have Veronica's Catering offering all of our Polish favorites. Access is partnering with a couple different restaurants to bring Arab cuisine to the festival in a number of different ways. And then new in 2024, which I think a lot of people will be excited about, is our Italian tent is returning. So Roman Village will be hosting the Italian tent. And if you are a traditional attendee of homecoming, you've probably asked where the Italian tent was in the last couple of years. And we're happy to say that we got it back. So pizza from Roman Village will be returning at homecoming.
Woohoo! There's a reason to celebrate right there. Oh my goodness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then of course, the burn drive will be returning. The Dearborn Firefighter burn drive will be returning, and they have their traditional corn as well. So whatever you want, we can probably feed you.
I love it. I love it. And then direct location. Where exactly do we find all of this fun?
Information about our food truck corridor and everything else we have going on at Dearborn Homecoming Festival can be found at dearbornhomecoming.com. And then you can come see us live and in person August 2nd through 4th at Ford Field Park.
Ford Field Park, just as we say, typically just that would be south of Cherry Hill, right?
South Brady Street and Cherry Hill.
Got it. South Brady and Cherry Hill. Easy enough. Parking. Shuttles,
yes,
how do we manage that?
If you are looking to park on site at Dearborn Homecoming Festival, we do offer public parking for a small fee. And that entrance to our parking lot is available off of South Brady Street. We'll have signs leading you all the way down. And then we also offer shuttles, complimentary shuttles from two locations across the city. We have one in East Dearborn at Dearborn Fresh and one in West Dearborn located at Dearborn High. And those shuttles will run all hours of the festival, beginning at noon and ending, I believe, about an hour after the festival, just so we can make sure everyone gets back to their cars safely. So again, those are complimentary shuttles that will run and allow people from different ends of the city to get to this festival and maybe not have to worry about parking if that's not something they want to do.
Excellent. Thank you. In terms of staking your claim for the big evening events, the traditional blanket, you know, blanket setup, and then we'll wrap up with our discussion on the fireworks. But are we still doing that this year? Is that allowed to put your blanket on the hill there?
So you are welcome to kind of claim your spot on the hill with a blanket, as is tradition in years past. However, we will note that one change that we implemented last year that will continue on for the future is that we do ask that people wait until festival doors open. We will not be allowing, of course, anyone on site before festival's doors open at noon each day of the festival. But once doors open, you're welcome to come in, stake your claim with a blanket. I say stake, but we do ask that you do not bring stakes or canopies or anything super heavy to weigh down that blanket. Just for safety reasons, but yes, after noon each morning, or each afternoon rather, you're welcome to come kind of save your spot.
Terrific. And then fireworks. Tell us about what to expect this year.
Yeah, fireworks will take place on Saturday and Sunday, and they'll occur immediately after each headliner set ends. So we estimate that's probably around 10 p.m. each night, give or take a couple minutes. The traditional fireworks show will be back. It's big, it's loud, and it is right there. And that's what people love about it. So Saturday and Sunday, we will have fireworks again at the festival.
Excellent. Well, we have covered every aspect that speaks to me. And again, I've enjoyed this event for so many years here in this community, as I know so many of our listeners have. But if someone is hearing this for the first time saying, I've always heard about homecoming, but I just didn't know, or I've never heard of this event before and I'd like to give it a try. We welcome you. Come out and see all the hard work as it has paid off, and it will pay off
Yes.
that Erica and her team has put into this event. Erica, last thoughts, anything that you wanted to add? Just maybe some suggestions, some tips before we wrap up today.
Sure. First and foremost, I just wanted to give a shout out to our supporters, our two presenting sponsors, J&T Korova Towing and Ford Motor Company, as well as our long list of supporters that, make this festival happen every year. They're a huge reason of why we're able to do this, why we're able to offer free entry. So I just want to give a shout out to them as well. You can check out our full list of supporters at dearbornhomecoming.com on our homepage. And I think aside from that, please come out. We're planning a really cool, jam-packed weekend full of fun and activities and music. Again, our goal this we have two goals this year: do something cool for the people of Dearborn and really put Dearborn on the map with other communities. And we're doing this for you guys, and we'd love for you to come out and see what we're all about if you haven't, or to make the trip back if you're a longtime attendee of the festival.
Erica Mara joining us. She is the director of the Homecoming Festival here, working representing the city of Dearborn. Thank you for your time, Erica. We can't wait to see all that hard work having paid off when we talk with you again and live at the festival. And just give your team all the best. And again, we just can't wait for a magical weekend. And again, as you are saying, and we have said in the past, and will continue to, there is no place like homecoming, and you'll find out
Absolutely.
why. Yeah. So thanks again, Erica. All the best to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me again.
Our pleasure. We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Do stay with us.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
Ooh, that felt good, didn't it? Just taking a few seconds to breathe deeply and relax. Well, we continue in the journal here on WHFR 89.3 at your FM dial. By the way, do come down to Concert of Colors. It is a world music diversity festival celebrating all things that are wonderful, eclectic, and universally global here in the Detroit area. We will be broadcasting live from Concert of Colors at WHFR's tent, and that will take place tomorrow and Sunday. We'll be there from about noon till about 8, doing some actual live performance broadcasting as well. So we're going to be down next to the Wolverine stage. Do come down and see us at Concert of Colors World Music Festival. It is just a beautiful and brilliant celebration of life and art and culture and music, and it's free above all. So what a great way to spend a weekend down in Detroit. And we will be at the, again, outside of the Wolverine stage, which is at the DIA, just not far, sort of near the Woodward and Farnsworth area. But do come down, enjoy a celebration like none other here in the Detroit area as it comes to music, global music, world peace, and so on. So in our last segment today, we're going to hear from a wonderful production by the LWC Studios for the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. This is out of Penn State University, and Jenna Spinelli hosts a series called When People Decide. So this episode talks about the concept of, by design, ballot initiatives require coalitions that cross party lines to secure votes needed to win. We also know that the polarization that exists in U.S. politics, well, it has some voters questioning the integrity of the two-party system, and others argue there are more than two parties in the system, just not being represented. Well, this piece is going to speak about the invisible third party of reform. This took place 2 years ago this week, and we think it's fascinating. Hope you enjoy the segment, The Invisible Third Party of Reform, from Public Radio Exchange. The show is called When the People Decide. We will have this wrap up our edition of the journal. Do enjoy. Have a great weekend and stay safe.
My parents will tell you that I have always marched to the beat of my own drum.
Thank you.
I read every book in my kindergarten classroom, spent a year on the soccer team that mostly consisted of dancing around on the field, and watched Monty Python and Eddie Izzard when most other girls my age were obsessed with Dawson's Creek and the Gilmore Girls. When I was editor of my high school newspaper, we ran a story about underage drinking that pretty much ensured I would never be part of the popular crowd, and I didn't mind one bit. I gravitate toward people who stand out from the crowd and see new ways of doing things. They're my favorite people to spend time with as friends and colleagues, and my favorite stories to tell as a reporter. Which brings me to politics. For the most part, it's all about fitting in with the crowd and not ruffling too many feathers. It frustrates me pretty much on a daily basis. And I know I'm not alone. In my work at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy, I've learned about communities of political reformers around the country, academics and experts, nonprofit leaders, and everyday people who volunteer their time to work for a healthier democracy. They're kindred spirits like me who don't accept the traditional narratives about how politics should work and who want to make politics work for them. Ballot initiatives are one tool they're using to form new coalitions that transcend political convention and, in some cases, go beyond the two-party system in the U.S. They're proof that finding common cause can bypass the polarization that plagues U.S. politics and deliver concrete wins to the people living in states across the country. This is When the People Decide. I'm Jenna Spinelli. In this episode, we'll learn about how grassroots reformers in Florida and Idaho are using ballot initiatives and participating in what some have called a modern democracy rebellion. Desmond Mead has always had a passion for the law.
Good evening. Oh, we have to try that again. Good evening.
This is Desmond giving a lecture when he won the Brown Democracy Medal from the McCourtney Institute for Democracy in 2021. The award is given each year to people who are doing innovative work in democracy. Desmond went on to become a 2021 MacArthur Fellow for his work restoring voting rights to formerly incarcerated citizens like himself. At the event, he spoke about his journey to becoming a respected civil rights activist, because it wasn't an easy one.
In August of 2005, I was standing in front of railroad tracks, waiting on a train to come so I can jump in front of it. That day, I stood there. I was a very broken man. I was homeless. I was addicted to crack cocaine. I was unemployed. I was recently released from prison. And the only thing I owned were the clothes that was on my back.
Desmond wrote about this in his book, Let My People Vote.
And I stood there and I waited and I waited. But God had other plans and that train didn't come. And I ended up crossing those tracks and I checked myself into a drug treatment facility. After 4 months of in treatment, in-house treatment, I was able to successfully complete that, and I moved into a homeless shelter. While at the homeless shelter, I enrolled in a local community college and was able to do real well to eventually get accepted into law school, and in May of 2014, graduating with a law degree.
Desmond told the crowd how during his time in recovery, Rosa Parks died. And he was watching all the people that paid their respects to her on TV and thought, I want that to be what my funeral would look like.
She did something that had a positive impact in people's lives. And that was very important for me because what it did, it allowed me to think about taking all of that pain and that suffering, that low self-esteem that led me to those tracks, and use it in such a way to help others so they wouldn't have to go to those railroad tracks.
It was in the process of finding his purpose that he stumbled upon the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, or FRRC. The mission of the FRRC is to end disenfranchisement and discrimination against returning citizens or people who have been convicted of crimes. I've talked to Desmond multiple times, including for this series.
I was introduced to the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition in August of 2006. It was my first convening, first time ever being involved in the coalition. And we're at the business meeting portion of the convening, and someone in their wisdom decided to nominate me to be the steering committee secretary with no typing experience or any or dictation experience or none of that. And I had my job as a secretary was to be on every call to ensure that I'm able to transcribe the minutes for the next calls. And you know, on these calls, you had some of the leading experts in felon disenfranchisement. It was an hour-long call each month. And what I would tell folks is that while they would get an hour worth of knowledge, you know, I would end up getting 8 hours worth of knowledge because I couldn't type fast. So I had to record the meeting. So I'm always playing back the recordings so I can ensure that I have the proper minutes for the next meeting.
Within a few years, Desmond became the executive director of the coalition and a leading voice in a campaign to reinstate the right to vote for formerly incarcerated citizens, just like him.
Me being a returning citizen and not being able to vote and not having my civil rights restored, there was a level of pain that I had that others didn't. And because of that intimacy with the pain, then there's a level of commitment to end the pain that have the potential of being unmatched as well.
After years of roadblocks and setbacks from the courts and the governor's office, the coalition decided to take the matter directly to voters with the help of the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonpartisan law and policy institute.
I think that there's no greater indicator of citizenship than being able to vote. And, you know, that is something that is extremely valuable. And to think that, you know, a handful of politicians had the power to decide which American citizen would get the vote and which won't get the vote, I thought was way too much power for any politician to have in their hands, whether they're Democrat or Republican. It didn't matter, right? Because when politicians are making those decisions, there's a likelihood that partisanship would play a role in deciding who gets the vote and who don't. With a citizens initiative, with a ballot initiative, then this one we're going to the people instead of the politicians.
That ballot initiative was Florida's Amendment 4, a grassroots campaign to restore voting rights to most of the nearly 1.5 million people in Florida with past felony convictions. Desmond highly values the grassroots part. He said this is the way he looks at the opportunity of a ballot initiative.
We put new politicians in charge, right, to help make our communities and our governments, whatever, a better place to live. And in one particular area, you failed. And so it seems like you can't get the job done. So we're going to do it for you, right? And one thing I loved about our campaign is that we did not rely on any politician to, number one, run our campaign, number two, support our campaign. We didn't want them anywhere near our campaign because it was an organic grassroots movement and we wanted to keep the pureness of it.
And part of being grassroots was making sure that the conversation starters and the way the issue was framed was done by people who knew what they were talking about from the bottom up.
You're talking about a very controversial subject when you talk about restoring voting rights to people with previous felony convictions. You're talking about doing it in a controversial state such as Florida and during a controversial time where there was so much division and fear. And so you would think that you would have to be real complex in engaging folks. But reality was, it wasn't complicated at all. You know, and the conversations were very basic conversations, which started out with a question. And that question was, do you know anyone who you love who's ever made a mistake? And that was it.
Amendment 4 passed in Florida with nearly 65% of the vote in 2018. The FRRC campaign had supporters ranging from Senator Bernie Sanders to the Christian Coalition of America and the Libertarian Party of Florida, over two dozen organizations and officials.
When we passed Amendment 4, we had support from Democrats, Republicans, Independents, young, old, white, black, Latino. It didn't matter. We had people from all walks of life, all political persuasions that came together to vote yes on Amendment 4. And I like to tell folks that, you know, those votes that we got was not based on hate or fear, but rather they were votes that was based on love, forgiveness, and redemption. And we showed that we can take an issue and elevate it above partisan politics, even implicit racial biases, right? And demonstrate that love can, in fact, win the day.
Desmond said he was fighting for the right to vote for everyone, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, because the right to vote is sacred to him. And he felt that the first time he got to use a ballot box.
What democracy means to me is what I experienced when I went to vote for the first time in over 30 years and when I voted in my very first presidential election. Walking into that voting booth, realizing that I was standing on hallowed ground because of the blood that was shed so I could have the right to vote, and recognizing that me actually voting, I was committing a sacred act, right? Because of the sacrifices. And as I was voting, I what I felt was what I was doing transcended politics, partisan politics. It transcended like the racial anxieties, and, you know, it took me to a place I thought that said something simple yet powerful. It said that I am. It said I count, that I matter. I'm a citizen of this country and my voice matters, right? And I realized that when I was voting, I wasn't voting as a Democrat. I wasn't voting as a Republican. I was committing an act as a human being. This was an act of validation of my humanity.
Desmond is still fighting for the right to vote for Floridians. We'll come back to him at the end of the episode. You could say he's part of a larger movement seeking to protect voting rights across the country from conservative-led efforts to restrict access to the ballot box. It's easy to see the reasoning behind Desmond's belief that politicians get in the way of voting rights. Republicans led a wave of voting restrictions across several states, and members of both parties stalled the bills that would protect voting rights in Congress. The tug of war between average folks in the U.S. and the politicians they elect has a long history, just like the ballot initiative. To touch on it, I want to return to the early 1900s, when the idea of a referendum or a citizens' initiative became a favorite tool of political reformers. I see them as the precursors to modern-day Desmond.
I always like the stuff that people have completely forgotten.
This is John Grinspan. He's a curator of political history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He studies what he calls the deep history of American democracy.
Our frame of reference for American politics is pretty short, and we have this incredibly long history of, you know, one of the oldest constitutions, some of the oldest political parties in the world. And very often I find that the moments that are most relevant to what we're going through today happened in the 1800s.
In this case, I reached out to John to tell me what he knows about the Progressive Era, which is the turn of the 20th century, early 1900s. When reformers started using the ballot initiative or referendum to pass progressive legislation, like women's right to vote or regulations on child labor. John said he became interested in this period's politics when he saw something curious about voter turnout.
Turnout was really high in the 19th century, and it was just one of those simple statistics that clearly had so much human experience and cultural baggage and everything built into the turnout statistics, which were really high from 1840 to 1900 and then kind of crash.
He began to see a correlation to progressive reforms and ended up with some pretty big questions about our political history.
All these things we really like about our democracy that we're pretty happy we have as innovations for the last 120 years come about at the same period that engagement and public attention in many ways falls off. And so this kind of paradox and this question of like, what does a good democracy look like? Do we want people in the streets or do we want really a few smaller number of really informed voters going to the polls? Do we want activists? Do we want random people from the saloon? What do we want our politics to look like?
John explained the reformers making those changes that we're generally happy about today, they were responding to the era of politics before them, the Gilded Age, an era he described as, quote, public, partisan, and passionate.
It's really high engagement by working class populations. This is an era when people who are less educated are more likely to go to the polls.
Of course, that was mostly white men. Women couldn't vote, and the votes of Black men were violently suppressed. Native Americans weren't even citizens yet. Politics was messy, and it was in the public sphere. Strangers talked politics on steamboats and in saloons. Giant political machines like Tammany Hall ruled cities like New York.
The critics in the early 20th century, the biggest thing they often saw was how stupid those elections were. They're often violent, poorly informed. There's fraud. There's vote buying. There's the use of alcohol to swing elections. They're pretty ugly, but they're also pretty engaging.
John said the parties didn't really distinguish themselves by policy. It was more about if you belong to a particular ethnicity or culture or race, you vote for X party. It's just a fact. For example, in the late 19th century, in a dozen states in the Northeast and Midwest, 70% of Catholics and 80% of Irish Catholics voted for the Democratic Party.
And the parties are so powerful, you can't just go up against them, but you can find ways around them because things like referenda, they don't take 80% of the enfranchised population to go vote. A lot of these innovations help mobilize a really active small core to make big change.
That big change ushered in the progressive era, nonpartisan politics that John described as, quote, private, independent, and restrained. It changed how we thought about the role politics should play in a regular person's life. No more politics at the dinner table or in the saloon.
In the early 20th century, you see this new sense, this kind of new cultural sense, especially among educated people in America, that politics should be driven by ideology. And you should read the different sides. You should read the pamphlets. You should understand how the parties feel about the tariff or about money or about whatever. And this is the era when you get all these progressive reforms.
These progressives created what has been called an invisible third party of reform. John imagined this is kind of what they were thinking.
If there's anything, any kind of stupid, unthinking thing holding us back, it's this iron partisanship that's keeping people from passing legislation we would agree on. You get kind of more than change growing from one party to the other. You get this, what they called an invisible third party of reform that isn't working solely through one party, isn't just Democratic, isn't just Republican, but is able to build chunks and factions of each party and of voters to really make a difference. And these elections, as I said, I think are really close. So you only need a tiny portion of the electorate to make big change. The closer the elections, and we have really close elections again today, the smaller the number of people you need to have any influence. It's interesting that we've hit this moment that feels in a way a lot like 1900 again, in good ways and bad ways. Good ways with the reform, bad ways with this question of voter suppression.
I also see lots of parallels with the way we see politics today, especially how we think of parties as blocking meaningful change. I heard this from Desmond in Florida and from the next campaign we'll talk about. That happened in the same year, miles away from Desmond in Idaho. In 2018, grassroots organizers in Utah, Nebraska, and Idaho bypassed their state legislatures to successfully expand Medicaid, a pretty progressive issue for these conservative states. And you guessed it, they did it with ballot initiatives. In Idaho, a scrappy group of friends led a campaign for what would become Proposition 2. Their names were Luke Mayville, his friend Garrett Strizich, and Garrett's wife, Emily. Together, they formed Reclaim Idaho. Luke went on Boise State Public Radio while the campaign for Medicaid was ongoing and talked about the origin story of Reclaim Idaho. He said it all started with his friends in their hometown of Sandpoint and a fight for $17 million in funding for their local school district. The district was asking voters to approve a tax known as a school levy.
A bunch of us learned that there was a school levy that was desperately needed to not to improve the schools, but just to keep them open. So a number of us came together and we organized a door knocking campaign around that school levy.
The levy passed by a margin of 2-1. Luke told the host of the local radio show that they saw the direct impact of their door knocking. It seemed to have increased voter turnout.
We stepped back and we thought, wow, that was inspiring. We think we really made a difference.
So like, what can we do next at this point?
What can we do and what can we do statewide?
Luke and his friends Garrett and Emily decided the equivalent crisis at the state level was access to Medicaid. A quick bit of history on Medicaid expansion before we get back to Luke's story. When the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010, it called for expanding Medicaid coverage to nearly all American adults with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. But states challenged this expansion, leading to a Supreme Court decision in 2012 that found it was unconstitutional for the federal government to force states to adopt the expansion requirements. If you've been listening to this show, you can probably guess where this is going. With no support from the legislature or the courts, people who wanted to expand Medicaid had to take matters into their own hands. And many of them, like Luke and his counterparts in Utah and Nebraska, did it through ballot initiatives. So Luke and his Reclaim Idaho buddies began campaigning for Proposition 2, to expand Medicaid eligibility to about 60,000 Idahoans who were being left out of the system. This is Luke in that Boise State Public Radio interview.
We have to turn this issue into a kind of spectacle that will make people pay attention. So we painted a camper bright green, and we put the words Medicaid for Idaho across the side of it, as if Medicaid were a statewide candidate running for office, like a governor candidate or something like that.
They drove their bright green camper van south from their hometown of Sandpoint, hitting 20 towns. Here's Luke talking one-on-one with me now, a few years after his campaign. He has good memories of that camper van.
Whenever we were able to organize an event, we would do some kind of event in the town. But more often, we would just show up in a busy grocery store parking lot, including in, you know, some of the most conservative towns probably anywhere in the country. And we would start a conversation with people generally by saying something like, just have a quick question for you. What do you think of, you know, getting healthcare in Idaho? Has it been a good experience? Have you been able to get the healthcare you need? And that was a really strong conversation starter. People almost universally would say no, you know, no.
Luke told me he remembers feeling like most people really wanted to engage with their conversation starter.
It always felt like enough people were willing to talk to us that it was worthwhile what we were doing. And that was before we even launched the signature campaign. We were kind of warming up to it. And what we did prior to having an actual petition to get signatures on is we carried around Sharpies and we had people sign our camper, like physically sign the outside of the camper, if they believed in what we were doing, trying to expand the Medicaid program. And then if they signed the camper, it was a really easy ask to then say, hey, could you also, sign this sheet and sign up for our email newsletter?
Luke and his colleagues used this long list of supporters when the time came to get signatures to put the proposition on the ballot. Like Desmond in Florida, Luke's conversations with voters appealed to a shared humanity rather than a specific issue.
But we were just showing up in very conservative places and going to grocery store parking lots and walking up to people at random, like no matter what they look like or no judgment of them whatsoever, and just asking them about healthcare and then asking them. And then our final question was specifically about what they thought of the idea of expanding Medicaid. And it was just overwhelming that people generally were, you know, warming up to that idea, and that there was very little opposition to it. And even when people told us they were opposed to it, they weren't that angry, actually. They were just kind of like, you know, they would give some reason why they thought it was a bad idea, but they weren't at our throats. They weren't yelling at us or anything. So we had, just from face-to-face conversations, we had a great deal of confidence that it was very popular.
Proposition 2 received wide support when it was in the signature gathering phase. Reclaim Idaho had to get signatures from 6% of voters in at least 18 of Idaho's 35 legislative districts. They met the criteria in 21 districts, turning in more than 75,000 signatures.
But it's really important for us that to always recognize that our progressive issues are actually popular progressive issues. So there are issues that are that have shown themselves to be popular in red states, which is something that I think many people falsely assume just isn't, just can't be the case. But what we found especially when you focus on these bread and butter issues of, you know, basic quality of life, you can build a majority coalition around issues that are typically considered progressive.
Proposition 2 passed in November 2018 with 60% of the vote. The measure had support from Idaho's Republican governor, organizations including the Idaho Medical Association and the Idaho chapter of the American Heart Association. And they won the majority of the vote in 35 out of 44 counties. Remember the camper van? It was there on election night.
Several of us were in a green camper doing a giant loop of probably about, you know, 600 miles total around the entire state and ending on election night back in our hometown. So we're celebrating this victory in a, you know, brew pub in the same place where we launched the whole thing.
The ballot initiative was the tool Luke was able to use to achieve his victory. How he was able to create a sort of invisible third party of reform within his home state.
And that's one of the great things about ballot initiatives that we found is people don't immediately place ballot initiatives in the same compartment in their mind that they place parties and candidates. So our initiative campaigns, if we do our work, they come across as just like good-natured, you know, well-intentioned civic enterprises. And that's been powerful for us.
Luke said they knew there was opposition to the initiative. The state Republican Party pushed back against Medicaid expansion. In 2019, Idaho's legislature tried to add a work requirement for many of the new Medicaid recipients, but the federal government did not approve it. But there was another part of the backlash that Luke did not expect.
Instead, the big threat turned out to be that some powerful legislators decided to come after the initiative process itself. Initially, if I remember, we were in a kind of state of disbelief when we first saw their bill, because it was so blatantly just an attack on a constitutionally protected initiative right that we have in the state.
Our next episode will dive deeper into attacks on the initiative in Idaho and other states. Are ballot initiatives really as removed from partisan politics as campaign organizers think they are or would like them to be? The parties aren't all bad, and let's face it, the two-party system probably isn't going anywhere anytime soon. Politicians, too, aren't going to give up their jobs in favor of folks like Desmond or Luke. For Desmond, back in Florida, legislators got in the way of the implementation of his ballot initiative. After Amendment 4 passed to restore voting rights to formerly incarcerated citizens, legislators in Florida decided to add a condition. These citizens would have to prove that they'd paid all court fines or restitution associated with their cases before they could vote. In other words, someone's voting rights would not be automatically restored as soon as they completed their sentence. The legislation was passed along party lines, and Desmond said it was very disappointing.
The first thing that came to my mind was just the arrogance of politicians. They were just arrogant. I liken it to a short story that I tell about a family. And of course, this is fictional, but it happens in real life, right? You have this family that's homeless and they're living in the streets. Rain, sleet, and snow comes, and politicians would walk past that family every single day for years and not lift a finger to help that family out. Then all of a sudden, the community decides to come together and say, well, if the politician's not going to help the family out, we are. And the community comes together and they build this family a home. As soon as the home is built, here comes the politicians wanting to dictate how the house is furnished, right? You know, when you have, you know, the executive and the legislative branch combining against you, there's not much you can do but, you know, roll up your sleeves and try to get in there and hope you can minimize the damage.
I saw a lot of parallels between the period John Grinspan studies and the work people like Desmond and Luke are doing. So I asked John to listen to some clips from my reporting to see if he could draw lessons or parallels from the era he studies.
I can say a few things that you see from this era that maybe would be useful. One of them, and this is just the biggest, boldest thing, is that reform really is possible.
And reform is possible, even when voters are split between the politicians they support and the changes they actually want to see in government, just like back in the progressive era.
There's a sense, there's a popular sense, that politicians and parties are standing in the way. I hear that from a lot of people, and I hear that frustration, but I do think it's also true that behind those parties are voters who are keeping those politicians acting the way they are.
He said it's not as easy to pull apart the players. It's not as simple as the people versus the politicians. A Pew Research study from 2020 found that even when taking independents' partisan leanings into account, 93% of voters identify with or lean toward either the Democratic or Republican Party.
Referenda and those kind of things are a good way to get people to think outside the box of that kind of restrictive tribalism. And that's really wonderful. And at times of kind of like locked in partisanship, that might just be the kind of the crowbar you need, the wedge you need to break things up. A state level referendum or something paying attention really closely to one issue, to healthcare, to, you know, insurance, to gun rights, to whatever it might be, is a way around the big obstruction in the center of American life.
And this tool is under threat across the country by politicians hoping to limit the ability of citizens like Luke or Desmond to propose policy changes directly to the people. When the People Decide is produced by LWC Studios for the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. The podcast is reported and hosted by me, Jenna Spinelli. Our producer is Paulina Velasco. Verilyn Williams edited this episode. Cedric Wilson mixed this episode. Fact-checking by Mark Betancourt. Thank you to Boise State Public Radio for the archival clips of Luke Mayville you heard in this episode. Thank you to David Daly for putting Luke and Desmond Mead on my radar in his book Unrigged. Finally, thank you to Hedrick Smith for his excellent PBS special, The Democracy Rebellion, which was one of my inspirations for making this series. I'm Jenna Spinelli. Thanks for listening.